On February 11, 1979, the Iranian monarchy was overthrown following several months of public unrest, social upheaval, and armed battle, leading to the triumph of the Islamic Revolution. 37 years have passed since those momentous days, and the first and foremost fruit of the revolution remains being the notion of independence, a matter which has also been veritably enshrined in the Iranian constitution ever since.
Hello and welcome to Iran Today here on Press TV with me, Zubin Zarvan. This episode, we're going to be discussing the anniversary of the Iranian Islamic Revolution. Stay with us.
Each year in Iran, the 10 days spanning February 1st through the 11th constitute a symbolic period, which encapsulates the final days running up to the revolution's culmination and are commemorated as the 10 Days of Dawn.
Well, this spirit of negating any foreign dominance over here in Iran has definitely brought about specific conditions, of which we'll be talking about further along in the program.
It might be argued that not all of the lofty goals initially pursued by the revolution have been properly realized over the past 37 years. However, one area on which friend and foe alike would agree as an achievement for the country is indeed the notion of independence.
The revolution rose up from the grassroots level. Political organizations and parties had no role in creating the Islamic Revolution, but they did have a part in the struggle and armed battles. This is a subtle point. In fighting the Shah, all have had their own fair share. We shouldn't deny that. It is history. But in the institution of an Islamic system and movement, not only various political parties and groups weren't supportive, but at times proved in opposition, both before the revolution and afterwards. But our people's faith and beliefs were so strong that despite the support of various Western intelligence services given to the Shah and his own strengths, the people's power prevailed. And all this was because of the leadership of Imam Khomeini.
Speaking of independence, one might argue, what kind exactly? You see, we've got 196 countries in the world today, and all 196 of them would consider themselves to be fully independent. But still, the discerning amongst us would definitely recognize there is a nuanced difference between a country that's a leading one and that which is just a follower.
Representing an ancient civilization in itself, Iran, formerly known as Persia, stands today as the oldest country in the world in terms of statehood. This also means the country has seen myriads of aggressive and invasive attempts on its soil and sovereignty throughout the ages. In order to get a better idea of just how independence and being independent matters to Iranians, I asked Javad Mansouri to tell us more about it.
The Iranian people, long before the revolution culminated in victory and from the Qajar period all the way down to the Pahlavi reign, and especially during the brief period when Iran was occupied by foreign forces during World War II, and particularly as a result of the American coup of 1953, among other instances, had grown opposed to foreign domination interference and the crimes committed by their local agents. This made the people realize that one of the core reasons for all the troubles befalling the country is in fact the foreign domination, and that it must be removed at whatever cost. No matter what sacrifice, the country must attain independence.
Needless to say, these dark patches in the country's history, given the retentive memory of most Iranians, have over the years led to a cumulative sense of distrust when it comes to any signs of compromise on the nation's sovereign rights.
In view of the American coup of 1953, where the democratically elected government of Dr. Mossadegh was overthrown, not to forget the British colonial projects prior to that, this sense of mistrust amongst Iranians is more so when it comes to American and British overtures.
This history of colonial interests in Iran in contemporary times is clearly linked to the country's vast oil and gas resources, the dominance over which has invariably been a major Western policy and pursuit in recent memory. We went to see Qasem Tabrizi, a contemporary historian, to hear his perspectives on the significance of the notion of independence for Iranians.
From 1953 all the way to 1979, we witnessed Iran becoming a colony of the US and under American dominance. The existence of over 100,000 so-called American military advisors, also Israeli military advisors, in addition their intelligence apparatuses, where from the whole region was being controlled. While the Iranian intelligence, SOVOK, and the army too were at the service of American advisors. During the 1970s, over 6 million barrels per day of Iranian oil were being exported, and the majority of its proceeds went to the US, even in terms of deals and buying American arms as advised by the advisors. Well, we were hurt politically and culturally. Elsewhere, Iran was forced to cooperate closely with Israel, to the extent that in many regional Arab states, Iran was seen as the brother of Jews.
The Iranian Popular Revolt of 1979 has, over the years, been analyzed from various perspectives. Specific circumstances of a misgovernance, or worse, a failure in governance by the monarchy in addition to tyranny, have usually been touted as the core reasons for the people's rebellion against the Shah. However, one constant throughout all these analyses is that the people of Iran had become fed up with a system that exhibited weakness and subservience toward foreign governments, especially Western ones.
This is perhaps why the main motto of the Iranian Islamic Revolution was essentially about the idea of negating any form of foreign dominance, be it from the West or the East.
Well, Iran did not really align with East or West, which was one of the slogans of Imam Khomeini at the very beginning of the revolution. Iran never aligned with the Soviet Union and definitely did not align with the West. And as a consequence of this, the Western powers especially fomented the eight-year war with Iran, with Iraq. This cost Iran pretty penny, both in terms of monetary damage and also manpower and the deaths, and millions of deaths in Iranians during that war. And it took all this time to rebuild this country, and Iran did very well for itself, but it charted its own course in both in how it conducted its battles, as it were, and how it reconstructed itself. And these are issues that the big powers have always cringed at Iran, especially over the last 37 years, beginning with actually the revolution itself that toppled their own puppet.
This era also marks the beginning of an organized Western propaganda and misinformation campaign bent on tarnishing the Iranian image and casting fear on Western and regional countries as to Tehran's pursuits.
These horrid modes of psychological warfare and media attacks are now seen as the very first steps of Western Iranophobic measures, which have lasted and even been intensified all these 37 revolutionary years.
Every colonial power in history, in order to justify its policies to its own people and its allies, has had to demonize its enemy. So absolutely, Iranophobia is very much connected to these efforts by the Western powers. to demonize Iran. Because otherwise, how do they justify, you know, their policies to their own populations, as well as to their smaller allies?
Every popular movement has a price to pay, and we, in fact, had to pay a 300-year-old price, which had come about due to alien domination and colonial attempts on our soil. This is where hegemonic and foreign domineering influence had seeped its roots in our society, the removal of which would have certainly taken time as it did. So achieving independence would have demanded perseverance, but also the passage of time in maintaining that momentum.
This tumultuous era coincides with the early days of a Western policy of sanctions and embargoes, where a great many Iranian overseas assets were frozen and numerous already paid-for purchase agreements or partnership contracts were preemptively dishonored and unilaterally rescinded. They particularly included major defense deals, as well as nuclear contracts. These assets are still being denied Tehran, even after 37 years. Perhaps Admiral Sayari, the commander of the Iranian Navy, is among the best people to tell us something about Iranian military advancements in the past 37 years.
In pre-revolution times, there were several military contracts that had to be delivered by the West, as all our equipment were foreign-made and we didn't have a local capability there. There were agreements for us to buy submarine and naval destroyers, but as soon as the revolution becomes victorious, all these deals which had been paid for are summarily scrapped. It got even worse, as they not only refused delivering what we had already paid for, but we were denied receiving after-sales services also, which was part of their commitment. What I'm saying is that the entire Iranian armed forces have been under sanctions from the very day the revolution triumphed on February 11, 1979. Even a few months prior to that, they were no longer honoring their training obligations either. It wasn't us asking them for anything. It is like the leader said once that during the war, when the invading army of Iraq was being armed to the teeth by US and Western governments, Iran was being denied even barbed wire.
Sanctions have been a staple feature of U.S. policy toward Iran for more than three decades. Washington first imposed sanctions on Iran over the 1979 U.S. embassy seizure. Embargoes were gradually reintroduced afterwards and under various false pretexts, and at the heat of the imposed war by Iraq, where the U.S., among many other powers, assisted the invading army of Saddam Hussein politically and militarily, as it bombed Iranian cities and used chemical agents on Iranian citizens.
The Iraqi-imposed war on Iran broke out under circumstances where just 19 months had passed since the revolution's victory, and the pillars of the revolution weren't firmed up just yet, and the state's foundation wasn't consolidated yet. As to the war, one could identify three causes for belligerence by Iraq. One is arrogance and vanity, and Saddam's very own personality. The other was Iran's weakness. After all, the country had just come out of a revolution. The IRGC hadn't been created yet, and we didn't enjoy a strong defense capability. And the third reason was the support given to Iraq by the West, the East, and local reactionary states.
During these 8 years, spanning 1980 all the way through 1988, Iran was under constant embargo, as it was under constant military threat and bombardment.
From before the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran used to be equipped with the very latest Western military hardware. Cases exist where Iran was supplied with military equipment even before it was made standard in the countries that developed it. For example, the US F-14 Tomcat or the British Chieftain tank. Primary suppliers included the United States, Britain, France, the Federal Republic of Germany, West Germany during those days, Italy, and indeed the then Soviet Union.
When our military warehouses and the parts stocks ran out, we were really stuck as to what can be done to redress both the spares shortage and the repair jobs, and just how to enter into the area of high-tech military software systems. but Imam Khomeini made a decree and the young revolutionaries listened. And that's how we began repairing equipment. As time passed, they mastered the craft. Then they stepped things up and started manufacturing parts and retrofitting equipments.
The continuation of the war eventually forced the country to develop its very own military capabilities to mirror the technologies of its likely adversaries and to provide a totally reliable source of equipment for the future.
Afterwards, we thought about making bigger vessels, such as destroyers. The Army Chief Commander had issued a decree to that effect, for which we quickly started the process, the result being the Jamaran destroyer as the first of its type which joined our naval fleet by 2009.
Tehran now boasts an indigenous defense industry of an international standard and of a high-tech nature. This is a strategic area in which Tehran is now even capable of commercial cooperation with interested foreign buying countries, especially in the region. And these are some of Iran's achievements in the area of missile defense technology in the past 30 years. In the realm of science and technology, too, Iran has taken great strides and achieved specific goals of a world-class stature. They cover many academic fields, from the engineering departments all the way down to niche medical sciences, where Iranian innovation is traceable by publishable and peer-reviewed standards, particularly in biotechnology and regenerative medicine, where Iran is now cutting edge and among a handful of nations, but also in areas of trauma and disaster medicine, namely chemical and biological defense and prevention systems.
Scientific development and technological development plays a very important role in your independence, no matter which country you live in. In the age where we live now, the science and technology is one of the main characters of strength of any society. Therefore, right after revolution, science and technology has always been a very important part of our development plans.
These areas are the same areas where Iran was hurt the most during the imposed war, a weakness which is now turned into a major strength and strategic capability. As it turns out, the 30-plus years of sanctions have also had some positive impacts.
We have to say that what we have achieved in the last 37 years really is based on a paradigm shift in our university activities from pure educational activity to the research-based and technological-based universities right now. For example, in 1979, the number of papers published in ISI index journals in Iran was maybe less than a handful of papers. This figure rose to more than 20,000 per year in the year 2014.
These are some of the scientific achievements of Iran in the past three decades.
In the era before the Islamic Revolution of Iran's victory, there were a lot of foreign physicians working in the country, namely from India. That's no longer the case. Life expectancy in the country was pretty low, and the rate of mortality and morbidity pretty high. All those things have changed for the better, for which we've come today to the Baghiatullah Medical Sciences University here in Tehran to get a better picture of the current status of the medical practice in the country, for which we're going to have an interview with the head of the university. How would you describe the difference between the status of the medical practice in our country before the revolution in comparison to the post-revolutionary era, and with regard to any comparison to the neighboring countries that we might have in the region, Turkey and the Persian Gulf countries?
Our country, from the very first days of the revolution, fundamentally changed the way medicine was being taught at the universities, where medical education, which was kept separate from clinical arenas, then after became every part of the same. This in and by itself was an innovation, which spearheaded many other developments in the same field. In reality, at the outset of the revolution, in terms of medical education, we had only 9 universities. Today, and in 2016, we have more than 72 medical universities. At the time of revolution, we had around 2,900 people in the universities as faculty. Now, though we enjoy having more than 16,000, that's a little less than 6 times in growth.
In the pre-revolutionary era, Iran was dependent on certain Western countries for many of its needs. They included also scientific and educational needs, where in the area of medicine, close to some 30% of Iran-based GPs at the time of the revolution were from the Indian subcontinent. At the moment, some 99% of local GPs are Iranians with local training and education.
At the beginning of the revolution, we could never train specialists locally for fellowships at the subspecialty level. The less than 200 subspecialists we used to had all been educated overseas. This is at a time when today we are proud to offer over 400 fellowships in all areas of subspecialty that exist on an annual basis. As a result, and in comparison to the beginning of the revolution, where we had just 200 subspecialists, we now boast having some 5,500 of super specialists working in our national network of medical practitioners, the majority of whom trained locally. This is comparable to that which is in, let's say, in Turkey, as an example of neighboring countries.
The systematic economic privation unleashed on Iran by Western states in the past 37 years, in terms of blanket embargoes and unilateral sanctions, the spate of organized hostilities applied against Tehran since 1979, are but a direct result of Iran and Iranians' patriotic bid for political and economic independence and cultural freedom from Western domination. This freedom hasn't come cheap or easy. The high price for achieving it has been paid in blood and sweat.
Iran is a country with more than 7,000 years of history. Iranian culture and Iranian beliefs is rooted to Shiite branch of Islam. So Iran and Islam, Iranian history and Islamic culture plays a very, very important role in shaping our culture these days. Sense of independence is one of the main pillars of our culture in general.
This freedom constitutes a supreme national integrity, which is viewed as non-negotiable, not just by the Iranian government, but also by the vast majority of Iranian people of all faith and walks of life. Before wrapping up this edition, how about touching base with our team by using these online channels? We'd like to hear your thoughts and would certainly welcome any suggestions, especially Iranian topics of your very own interest.
And that's all for this week's edition of Iran Today here on Press TV with me, Zubin Zarvan. Thanks for watching us. Till we meet again, it's goodbye.